Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. This is part two of my interview with winemaker from China, Lenz Moser. And it's funny to say from China because you see the Moser name and you think Austria. And in part two, we start off by having a conversation about just was he scared about trying to make wine in China? And this goes back to when he first visited there in 2005. And coming from Austria to China, that is absolutely a culture shock. It's a wine shock. And so we pick this up. We try more of the great wines and just a really interesting conversation with a very famous individual from the Austrian wine scene and now making a name for himself, making some of the best red wines in all of China. Again, as I mentioned the last part, if you're looking for a fun Twitter and Instagram account, check out Wine Bottle Travels. It's myself, my girlfriend, a twin sister, and another friend. It's basically us trying to help you out when you're traveling, when you're trying to find wine, just a fun place to learn a little bit about wine and learn a little bit about travel. Anyway, here it is, part two of my interview with Lenz Moser.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
I would imagine a lot of people, they would, especially coming from a conservative background in European wine, then going to China, I imagine it would scare off a lot of people. For yourself, and I imagine part of it was the Mondavi influence, instead of being scared off, you look at it more as an opportunity.
No, I went to China because I was curious, and a friend of mine said, well, check it out. Mm-hmm. And I don't disguise the fact that in 2005, when I went there, I fell in love immediately with this country, and I had no idea because China was a blank spot for me in terms of history, of my knowledge about China. It just was not on my radar because my Austrian wines, which I was selling at the time, they were white, and I knew it was a red wine market, so I didn't even bother.
Yeah.
But then a friend said, check it out. And you know, then I had this moment in my life, I said, okay, I'm staying here. And I developed my mission to help to bring Chinese wines to the world at this stage already, because I believe in purpose. You have to have a higher aim in life in order to be really successful. It's not just the money you're working for. It's more than that, and being part of something. And this drives me, basically.
Cars, money, all of that, it's all nice. But what drives you when you wake up in the morning, you're not thinking about money. You're thinking about what you can try to accomplish, what you can create. What is the next wine? What should be the next wine?
The next wine is Moser Family, Cabernet Sauvignon. It's the first wine which we put into barrique. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, a completely different style of wine. It's a 16. It's my second vintage in China, which I've done, because I started in 15. And it's done to a specific style. We call it second vin, but it doesn't follow the French rule of basically being the leftover from the grand vin. It's different vineyards, different making. It's different barriques as well, because it's used barrique. And we age it there for 2 years, exactly 2 years.
Two years used barrique, 100% Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yes, 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. And it's one of my most successful wines because We hit the sweet spot on pricing and on quality. It's a big star in London in the best restaurants there. And by the way, the Swedish monopoly buys nice quantities year after year and is always sold out in 3 weeks, which is always a very, very good sign.
A little more smoky.
Yep.
Spice is there, but smoky is one of the first things that come. The plum is coming out. Yeah, there's a little more depth on this one than the first. A little bit of violet, but yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot going on the nose on this fella.
It's a more concentrated version of Saint-Estève. Hence, my benchmark wine on this, when I do the blends and everything, is always Filon Segur, which is one of my favorite wines in my entire life. It's a 50 euro bottle in Europe. Mm-hmm. much What's more
this,
here.
What does this go for?
In Europe, this goes for 35 euros. Yep. And so it's a very good price quality ratio as well. And it's something you open and you don't have to discuss always the wine. You just enjoy the bottle of wine over good food. Think of steak, think of a nice piece of cheese, and here you are.
Good acid, very drinkable, very smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is that nice balance. There's depth. There's a lot you can say about it, but it's funny. Sometimes you use the word enjoyable, and some people can take offense to it. Oh, yeah, your wine's very enjoyable because it makes it seem like it's not memorable. But a wine can be both just very enjoyable, but then you can stop, take a look around, and realize there's a bunch going on.
Well, I'm Bob Mondavi School, if you like, and I'm taking this up because he always says, make friendly wines as opposed to cerebral wines. Mm-hmm. And because wine should be part of the good life, and then it cannot be too complicated. Because we wine people sometimes overthink our own wines.
Yeah.
And we think people discuss wine over a meal. Nothing farther from the truth. Because
yeah. We do, but yeah, 99% do.
Absolutely.
Not.
People want a nice bottle of wine over a good meal with friends. And my job is to enhance that party and to enhance that time you have together with friends and good food. Mm-hmm. That's all. Because, and that's why I believe also in brand with wine is the connotation is not a good one, but with the name of a wine. So when people have a bottle of Robert Mondavi or Ordinaria or you name it, or our wines from the Chateau, then they should have the reassurance it's something good and it enhances their time together. Then I'm winning already.
Yeah.
If they have to discuss the wine, then there's too much fuss.
How different is, and it's a short period of time, 15 years is it's a second, it's a blink of the eye. How different is the Chinese wine industry when you got started in 2005 versus today?
Well, I got started in selling the wines in 2005,
right,
until 2015. And then I stopped selling because I could not credibly sell the wines anymore unless I was making the wines myself together with my Chinese winemaking team. So my time with China really starts 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
With 2015. And I always say a little bit provocatively, if you like, any wine before the year 2015 cannot be a good wine in China because there was none, at least not to my knowledge. There's always an exception
to
the rule. But winemaking in China really started in 2015 with one simple trick. When we started making the wine, we broke with the paradigm of the Moon Festival because the Moon Festival always marked the end of the harvest. And if you were unlucky with the lunar calendar, you would pick unripe grapes.
And you were forced to because of...
Yes, because of the workers. The
right.
Workers would leave.
Okay,
because
yeah,
when China goes on a festival,
yeah,
like New Year's or Lunar, in the Moon Festival, they just leave their work for a week or two.
Yeah.
And the country is shut off and nothing happens anymore. And the big, big challenge in 2015 was to postpone the vintage or the harvest by 2 weeks, and we got lucky because we've done it. And ever since, in China, wine has become much more qualitatively known because we have the ripeness now, provided we have good grapes. And in Ningxia, we have good grapes because we have desert climate, so we have the perfect grape,
mm-hmm,
small berries anyway. And therefore, we got lucky from the start with a great vintage, postponing the vintage, and here we are.
How would you define what winemaking culture was like before 2015 versus 2020?
It's a gradual process because
yeah,
there's a lot of WCD training going on, a lot of people returning from studying abroad. So it's a process. What I can say is that the development of China is like everything in China. It's very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last 5 years, I can say that the wine industry has improved tremendously which I've never seen in my life before, because when I talked to my father, who grew up after the war in Austria, and we were drinking a lot of bad wine there too, by the way. So it's not just a Chinese phenomenon.
Yeah.
And Germany and all the other countries, France. So after the war, you know, the guys who produced most and the most quick, they won, and the quality only came in the 70s and in the early 80s. And the same is happening in China, but it's so fast. Because China is ambitious. China has this ambition to show the world what they can do, because they want their place in the world back they had in the 1850s. Because China was always a major force in the world with about one third of the GDP of the world. And they are on the best way to get it back. And then they are content again. They are not going to conquer the world. But they have a very, very certain pride, and they want to show that they can do it again. And
right.
Now the wine industry discovered, hey, we can do it also with wines, and they want to prove the point.
Would some things that would surprise North America about either the wine culture the wine culture in China?
Well, there is no wine culture at this stage, because it's so new.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is what I really like is a very good marketing tool in China. You have this gambei culture. That means you walk up to someone, you give a toast, and you say gambei, and then you have to empty the glass, no matter how full it is.
Ah.
And I tell you one thing, as a long nose, as we call they call me, you are a target of gambei, because we have these round tables, 15 people, and each and one of the other 14 people comes up to you and says gambei. But I can take a little bit more than my friends there, so I'll survive. Last man standing type of thing. But
I hope you don't have a busy day the next day if you've got a 15-person gambei.
You get used to it, and you know you don't have to do it every day. But gambei is a thing to get a party started. So when I do a official presentation sometimes in Europe as well, then I start with a gambei. And you would be surprised how people respond to that. And we have so much fun with doing that, because I'm just not bringing Chinese wine to export markets. I'm bringing habits as well. And this is a lot of fun.
Of course. Sounds like a lot of fun. How important is it? And, you know, maybe it's better now than a couple of years ago when you started. But how important is the London Wine Fair to make a name for yourself and just how important is the British market for what you want to accomplish?
Well, the British market is very, very important, I think, for every winery on this globe, because it's what I consider to be the toughest wine market in the world, because everybody wants to go there.
Right.
They have a very, very small but very good wine industry. About 1% of their consumption is made at home, and this is a new phenomenon anyway. So competition is really fierce. So this is why early 2017, when I started my export mission, I went to London first, and we launched our wines in London first. And since we were very successful from the very beginning, we went across the ditch to Europe as well, and we launched then in Europe as well. So nowadays we are represented in 25 countries in Europe. And also another 15 globally, like here in Ontario.
Yep.
And soon in other parts of Canada too.
Hopefully. Where can we find your wines?
Say again?
Your wines here, will they be available? Or maybe I can ask some of the reps here, just where can we find your wines? Like at the LCBO?
At the LCBO, we had all four wines listed at the LCBO.
Mm-hmm.
But they were sold out within less than 3 weeks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it was a big surprise. First of all, that the LCBO took us on with four wines. And we sold out. So, but we are in the process of getting the wines again into this country.
Is there a fourth wine to try? If not, because I see that nothing else is open. I don't.
Well, we should open this one as well.
I'm not going to disagree. If you want to open that, I can talk for a little bit. Oh, I thought it was twist top. Where I want to go after we talk about this wine is something that you've talked a lot about. And in fact, we were talking about where it started, the environment. And the fact that London or England now drinks 1% of their own stuff, I do wonder how much of English wine, and not sparkling, even just the dry stuff, how much of it is because of global warming, because You know, the average temperature is a little bit warmer, which makes it possible to make wine in the southern part of England. And so, yeah, Lens, I'd love to get your thoughts on just what you're doing, your practices in terms of trying to make sustainable wine and your own thoughts towards the environment.
Well, the global warming is a simple fact, because when I was a student, I did a study for my father, who wanted to invest in English vineyards. But mind you, that was a long, long time ago, in the late 70s. And at the time, it was impossible. Now, the English wine industry is adding 1,000 hectares per year. So that's a fact. And in Austria, we have the same effects. It's getting warmer and warmer. Average temperatures are rising. And what we adopted this year, and I'm happy to report with my CEO meeting in Yantai end of December last year, we adopted more than one measure. For instance, we are going biodynamic with the vineyards of the Chateau in the next 3 years. So that's number one. It's doable because we have a desert climate, so it's not too difficult. It's just the method is something we have to apply. And then what we are doing as well, we are going to get rid of all the capsules of our wines. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a paper lid in the future.
Yep.
Like Alois Lageda from Alto Adige is doing. It's beautiful. Looks good and is good for the environment. And I think most important is we are going to chip away about 20% of the glass weight. Our bottles are far too heavy. And that's another one. We are not going to wooden cases. We use all in cardboard cases, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And even when it comes to my own travel, I try to skip every second trip now. I try to offset my carbon footprint with a method which I'm still researching. Because, mind you, I produce 1,500 kilograms of CO2 coming to Toronto from Austria. It's a lot of things, and going back is another one. So we're really adopting a lot of things to contribute to making our world a little bit cooler again.
I imagine Napa, when you talked about making the bottles lighter, that's something a lot of the Napa cab producers could do. They got the big, thick bottles, the big, thick punts. I think part of it is just it's an ego thing. It's you know, making the wine look more glamorous, luxurious, decadent, but it doesn't actually impact the quality of what you're drinking.
Not at all. And I'm not in glass manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the European consumer is very, very responsive to all these ideas. Mm-hmm. Because our thinking is not just because of Greta Thunberg, but you know, we have our responsibility in Europe for the environment, and I'm extremely happy that my Chinese friends are responding very, very positively to environmental issues as well.
On this wine, my first thought is there are some similar notes to the last one, but there's a higher level of elegance to what is going on in the nose. I haven't tried it yet, but just, I mean, this is a beauty. And by the way, just for the listeners, what the final wine, this is your Grand Vin. So this is your top level wine. So what distinguishes this one from the last one we had in terms of production and so forth?
It's again, a completely different vineyard, mm-hmm. different sites, different selection process.
This would be obviously your best site.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And what defines it? What makes it the best site?
It's the oldest vines, mm-hmm. and it's a very special vineyard. You know, adjacent to the chateau. It's just it starts 20 meters from the chateau. It's a five hectare plot, and it's a beautiful vineyard, and it's special clones, and it gives us the smaller berries in a very, very healthy status. And then we do all these sorting techniques. We even have the sorting machine from Bucher, you know, the optical sorting. And then we use only new barrique for 2 years.
Okay.
French barrique.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So medium toast.
A little more elegance. A little bit of mint.
Yes, it's much more concentrated.
It's
really a thick and this is a big boy.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This is, you're having this with the ribeye. Yeah, you're not breaking this. This is the first wine is your Tuesday wine. The second wine is the weekend is here. the final one is it's for your birthday.
Yes.
For it's
Christmas, for Easter, whatever. Yeah, that's for celebrating.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And the only mistake we did with this one, we should have opened it because in 2 hours' time, it's much, much better.
Of course. Absolutely.
Really, it begs for air. And then it opens up and gives you the full complex components of the wine itself.
You know what I'm thinking? I talk to a lot of Ontario winemakers, BC winemakers, and the one thing that they won't always say it, but I know it's there, is they want to be able to do what you know, when you do the blind tasting, that their wines deserve to be in the conversation, where you can get a bunch of good Prince Edward County Chardonnay, and it can go up against Burgundy. And same thing with some of the Pinots, can go up against Burgundy, that the BC Bordeaux blends can go against Bordeaux. And it's really not about, let's beat them. It's more, we want to belong in that conversation, and we want to at least be seen with the same level of respect that when you see a wine, from your appellation, from your winery, that it is seen the same way as someone from Bordeaux or Napa. And I feel like that's the same thing in Canada, like with our producers, that there's a bit of a chip on the shoulder that no. Yes, we're young. We haven't been making wine for 400 years like you guys, 500 years like you guys have, but we deserve to be in the conversation.
Yeah, that's what we are going after as well. But we must not forget one thing, that we are the new kid on the block, because we are tasting my second vintage of Grand Vin here, and I know there's a lot more to come, because 19 is in the cellar already, and I know what kind of quality this is, and it's getting better year after year. What we have to achieve, and that's why my respect for Bordeaux in particular, but also now for California and some other regions in the world, is so high, because consistently year after year they are producing very, very good stuff, increasing quality. And we have to do the same in order to deserve the same respect. So we are at the beginning of something.
Yeah,
I'm extremely lucky and proud of what we have achieved already in such a short period of time. But our success will be defined in decades and not in years. So I always remind myself,
you got to be.
You have to have this to be humble enough to recognize the fact that yes, we compare ourselves with Bordeaux and Opus One and all this nice stuff, but we have now to prove our point year after year.
By the way, a little bit of savory, a little bit of meaty notes now coming out. I haven't had a sip in about 45 seconds. Is it difficult? Because earlier you were talking about the one thing about China is the ambition, the go full speed. They want to prove. Because in some ways, there's a bit of a push and pull, because they want to go full speed. But to make, like, for these wines to continue to prove, it, as you mentioned, it's not judged in years, it's judged in decades, because, you know, vine age and figuring out the exact microclimate and figuring out, okay, half a kilometer over there on that hill, you're going to do better than what we got here. You know, everyone's got such a head start. Is it tough? Because I imagine sometimes the ambitions from the Chinese wine industry, they're going to want to go at 100 miles per hour, and you might have to pull them back a little bit and say, hey, this is going to take some time.
No, managing the expectation internally and externally is part of my job.
Yeah.
100%. But I have no problems with that, because where I come from, we measure success in generations and not just in making a good wine in a given year. I'm here to tell this to my people and to take them with me on this journey, because sooner or later they will be able to do this alone. But this is a long, long journey for both of us.
Yeah.
And since I'm on the label, I intend to stay there anyway. But it's good to have ambition, because I tell you one thing, in Europe we're a little bit complacent.
The thing is, it's almost the fat cat syndrome.
Yeah.
You've had so much success and press and acclaim that, you know, part of it is, it's benefit of the doubt. 1 year, let's say you don't work as hard as you can.
Yeah.
You know, you can probably get away with it because you have a beautiful microclimate and you have the infrastructure set up, and people are going to give you the benefit of the doubt. You know, for Latour is going to get the benefit of the doubt. You guys in China are not. So it, in a lot of ways, it forces the ambition and it forces the work ethic because, you know, you've got to fight harder for respect.
No, for sure. But we are the newcomers. And yeah. I think this is the way it should be, that we have to work and to try harder. And I took on the challenge. And my mentors, especially in the New World, Bob Mondavi, always kept telling me that this is the case. You know, we have to rub shoulders with our cousins in France, he always said,
yeah,
in order to prove our point. But he knew that he will never achieve the status of Bordeaux in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for sure I will never achieve the status of Bordeaux in my lifetime because it's 300 years of difference.
Yeah, of course.
And that's what it is. And I think they earned their stripes a long time ago, and they need us. The French and the top producers from the old world need us to poke them a little bit.
Yeah,
and
to push them. Competition Absolutely. Creates a better product.
And I think at the end, our goal is that the consumer is winning.
Yeah.
This is at least my goal.
That's the perfect way to put it. More options, consumer wins. You push the big established to force them to innovate to be better.
Yeah.
The consumer wins. That's a great way. Yeah, absolutely. That is a great way of putting it. Because you grew up in Bordeaux and you have a lot of contacts there and a lot of friends there, is there anyone in Bordeaux, you know, going, hey, Linz, what are you doing? Why aren't you on Team Europe anymore? You're going off to China and now you're competing against us. And I'm not even saying like it's been like super negative, but if some people going, hey, what are you doing?
Absolutely right. And I just returned from Vinexpo in Paris.
Yeah.
10 days ago.
Some people are going, traitor.
And I'm really happy to report that on the back of the quality here, we signed up one of the best importing companies into France.
Yeah.
Oh, and nice. We even talked to some of the negociants in Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to take us on because they see exactly what I said to you earlier, that the French need this competition in order to not fall asleep again. Because they fell asleep in the 60s and the 70s, and then the Californians came and woke them up, you know, yep. Judgment of Paris and all that stuff. And they really responded very positively and take the wines from the 90s and the early 2000s of Bordeaux. I mean, they showed the world again who is the master. And I think they need the kick again from the people like us.
Before we end this with what you hope for these wines will be in 10 years, I'm curious, your schedule in a given month in terms of how much you have to travel, you know, from, you know, to go to China or to sell the wines, like what does a month look like? What does a busy month look like for you in terms of travel?
Well, I do about 200 flights a year and I go 5 times to China. I will be going to the States in the future because we're looking for an importer there. I'm pretty sure we'll have one very soon. Canada is again on my travel schedule because we have partners here. So I live on a plane basically, if you like. But since I've been doing this for my entire life, it's not a hardship.
Yeah, you see.
It's the opposite because I draw a lot of my inspiration. People meeting people like yourself and your friends here in our friends here in Canada, and listening to what they have to say about my wine, and if they finish the bottle, you know, because what we say and what we drink is sometimes two things, and that's my life basically, and I love it, and I wouldn't do something else.
Chateau
Changyou Moser 15.
Changyou Moser.
Changyou Moser 15. Yeah.
You can definitely taste the progression. You can definitely taste each one has their own identity. Each wine has their and what's that? You got the purple air. What is the what is that last one?
I have two new things to present to Fonterra today, to Andrew,
yeah.
Later on, which I brought in my suitcase. They are not officially launched yet. There's one white Cabernet aged in barrique, which is a fantastic comparison with any Chardonnay from California. You will love it. And then purple air comes from the east. It's the new icon from the winery.
Mm-hmm.
I have to sort of take up the challenge which Louis Vuitton with Ao Yun did with us, and Lafitte in Shandong with Longdai as well. So this is one of the absolute best wines from Asia, and it'll be launched in the very near future at Provine in 4 weeks' time.
What's the varietal for Purple Air?
Well, it's all Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay, so it's all Cabernet Sauvignon.
I don't have anything else.
Okay, of course, yeah, you don't have any of the grapes. So it's not like you Petit Verdot or Cab Franc.
I'd love to, believe me, but it's not there yet, but we're working on this as well. But Purple Air comes from the East is a very, very positive saying in China. That means fortune comes from the East. Every positive developments come to me, and this was a calligraphy given to me 5 years ago. And ever since, I was thinking about making a wine, but I had to find the right vineyards, the right grapes first. This is in the making now for 3 years in particular, and I'm extremely happy with the result.
What do you think you'll be in 10 years in terms of your wines, the development? I always like to ask that question of any winemaker.
Well, first of all, I'll be hopefully still ahead of the game from China, being the number one exporter of top and premium wines. And secondly, I want the consumer to recognize the fact that I'm trying to get better year after year. And thirdly, very important, when you sniff in 10 years' time into my glass, you know immediately it's Ningxia.
Yeah.
And you know immediately it's Moser 15.
Yeah.
Then I will be very, very happy.
It's a great answer. You smell and you go, nope, this is not Sonoma. It's not Napa. This is Ningxia.
That's the point, yeah.
And that seems kind of feels like the goal of every winemaker, respecting the terroir and respecting where they make their wine. I can just tell people, if you see Changyu Moser, of any of the wines from the Grand Vin down to the first one that we tried, if you're a fan of Cabernet, give these a shot. Part of the reason of this podcast is to open people's minds up, try different wines. Try these wines from China. Do not be afraid of the name of the country. 25 years ago, people would have wondered, why would I drink Cab Franc from Ontario? And now Ontario makes great Cab Franc. Same thing, just in a different country. This has been great. This has been a real learning experience for me. It's one of the reasons why I love doing this podcast. It's an honor to, as someone who studied your family when I was going for my sommelier degree, it's really cool to meet you. I really appreciate you doing the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. All the best here and all the best in their future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for everyone listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.